sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Yashiv Drori, a researcher at Ariel University who's discovered ancient grape varieties from biblical times and is creating wine from them. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've been preparing for a sabbatical that I have coming up in January, a liberating four-month break from my regular work that has been coming for a long time. It's fairly common for clergy, Jewish and Christian alike, to receive some kind of break for spiritual development, study, or service every 7 years. While for professors, a sabbatical means either a semester away from their regular university commitments, or even a full academic year to write or do scholarship, for clergy, these sabbatical breaks are often shorter, ranging from 3 or 4 months to as much as 9 months away from their congregations. Why, you may ask, do clergy receive this apparent perk when most Americans must make do with 2 or 3 weeks of vacation annually? Well, there are two primary reasons. First, in America, congregational clergy, like, you know, rabbis, are essentially on call 7 days a week, 365 days a year. While we receive 1 day a week off of work, and that day is not the Sabbath for the obvious reason that we must conduct services, sometimes multiple services, on Shabbat, that 1 day off is often compromised by phone calls, texts, emails, or crises that have to be answered, whether or not it is theoretically a day off. If there is a death in the congregation, we can receive that call at any hour, just as we do when there's an accident or medical emergency or a person in emotional turmoil. This is our calling, our service, and our job, to respond when called, and we do. And we are grateful for the opportunity to help and to serve. But that does mean that over the years we work on average 1 more day a week than most people do, and in practice, it's often 2 more days every single week. Over 7 years, that does add up. An extra 52 days of work a year, and that's not counting the 1 day off that isn't really off. In 7 years, just the one extra day would be well over a full extra year of labor. Therefore, a sabbatical of 4 months, in my case, is, you know, sort of what you get. Not exactly an even trade, but valued and treasured nonetheless. Now, the second reason that clergy receive a sabbatical is because the Torah says so. Allow me to explain. According to the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, our ancestors in Israel were commanded to let the land lie fallow for 1 year out of 7, to observe a Shemitah, a sabbatical year. And just as every 7th day was supposed to be a day of complete rest, a Shabbat to God, so every 7th year the land and its inhabitants were supposed to rest as well. It turned out to be good ecological practice, and our ancestors observed this Shemitah year pretty faithfully and kept the concept alive up until today. That means that they did not use the produce of the land of Israel in the sabbatical year, but left the fruit on the trees and the grain in the fields for the poor and the stranger to harvest as they wished. And they, too, ate only what they could take easily, without serious efforts at cultivation and harvest. This concept is still observed, to a degree, in Israel today. Much of the produce that would otherwise be raised in the land of Israel is officially transferred to a non-Jewish owner, a kind of legal loophole that keeps Israeli agriculture solvent during the sabbatical year. And there are some aspects of the biblical sabbatical, the Shemitah, that unfortunately did not make it at all to the modern world. For example, according to the Torah, all debts were forgiven during the Shemitah, and everyone who owed money was allowed to cease paying the loan from the sabbatical onward. Today, the Shemitah has become a wonderful opportunity for something else, spiritual growth, partially associated with agriculture, our connection to the natural world, ecology, and, well, our own characters. We can take this time to grow in our awareness of our dependence on God for sustenance, to give thanks for the bounty of the earth that allows us to enjoy our lives and our world. You know, kind of a greater version of the Thanksgiving holiday that's coming up soon. The sabbatical, the Shemitah, is a time to literally focus on growing ourselves instead of our crops, growing our character rather than our bank accounts. It's a great lesson. Now, to my own sabbatical in this sabbatical year, starting in January, I'll have the privilege of traveling around the world with the goal of visiting the holiest places on earth. This will be a kind of quest. I hope to discover what it is that connects all of these holy places, both incredibly ancient and quite contemporary, that people have found to be profoundly sacred. This journey will occupy the better part of 3 months. I hope to learn and grow and experience many new and exciting places and cultures in this spiritual odyssey. I will talk about it more as it approaches, but for now I must simply share my excitement and the incredible potential that this trip provides, this sabbatical. The Two Jewish Radio Show will continue, and I hope to have shows prepared for each Sunday that I am gone over this sabbatical. I haven't yet missed a show in 12 and a half years, including a previous sabbatical, and I don't intend to start missing them now. But in truth, the concept of Shemitah, of sabbatical rest, is a powerful and beautiful one, and I hope to live up to its spiritual potential in this coming journey, set to begin in about 2 months. But that is then, and this is now. And so to play us in this morning, here's a fun, energetic, Sephardic song to Shimon Bar Yochai, a mystical song. Bar Yochai was the 2nd century Jewish mystic whom tradition credited with the creation of the Zohar, the greatest work of Kabbalah. It's sung by Laura Wetzler.
Bar Yochai, nimshach tashrecha, shem tzason lechaverecha. Bar Yochai, nimshach tashrecha, shem tzason lechaverecha. Shemen Meshchat Kodesh Nimshata Mimidat HaKodesh Tassat HaTzitz Nezer HaKodesh Chavush Al Roshka Perecha Yesod Yesod Bar Yochai Moshe Tov Yashavta Yom Nasta Yom Asher Barachta Tuvim she'amadat kanit erodcha va'ederecha Netzach, netzach hod Bar Yochai, atzei shittim ondim Lodei Adonai, hem lo ondim Or mufla, or ha'ekod hem yoti Halohem, yorucha morecha
That was Laura Wetzler's version of the classic Sephardic and Mizrahi song to one of the greatest Jewish mystical figures of all, Shimon Bar Yochai. By the way, during my coming sabbatical, I fully intend to visit the cave that Bar Yochai is supposed to have hidden himself in for 13 years to survive the Roman occupation. In that cave, he found the inspiration from God to develop Jewish mysticism into a new and dynamic experience of holiness. May it work that way for us today. Hopefully without having to hide in a cave for 13 years. Well, wine has been a staple drink of Mediterranean cultures for thousands of years, but when Israel reestablished its wine industry in the 19th century, it did so with grape varieties taken from Europe. Now, a researcher in Israel has found seeds from grapes of biblical times, and sometimes whole grapes, and he is recreating literally the wines of Israel from the Roman era and from much, much earlier. Find out what we think King David drank and how soon you'll be able to taste it when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Eliashiv Drori, who is an expert on the plants of ancient Israel. He is a professor at Ariel University, where he has a laboratory and has created... Well, we'll let him tell you about it. Good morning and welcome. Shalom.
Good morning. Shalom, shalom.
So, archaeological excavations are famous for uncovering stones, but sometimes they also uncover seeds. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the business of growing really ancient plants.
Okay, actually, we started by growing... nowadays, plants, and only from the curiosity, we went back into ancient plants. What actually happened was that we started collecting Israel's native indigenous grapevine varieties. The reason for that is that actually about 2,000 years ago, we had a big, big wine industry in Israel, but during the 7th century, the Muslims came in. And they started destroying the wine industry for religious reasons. They are not allowed to drink any wine. And for that reason, from there on, the wine industry started going down and wine varieties disappeared. We are trying to re-establish these wine varieties and doing that by collecting all over Israel from the wild and neglected villages and so on. And we found more than 300 varieties, that about 100 of them are unique and unique to Israel and very interesting varieties. Now we wanted to actually close the circle and understand which of these varieties that we find today were used to produce wine in ancient times. And doing that, in order to do that, we actually collect seeds from archaeological sites. And we, mostly from wine presses, and we're trying to reconnect the two groups by morphological aspects, meaning the shape of the seed, and genetic analysis of both populations. And that, if we could actually close the circle, that would be a big thing for the wine industry of Israel.
It's quite extraordinary. Out of 300 varieties of grapes, what percentage are suitable for making wine?
So we could actually talk about the 100 unique varieties.
Sorry, right, because obviously...
interesting, yeah.
Right.
So out of these, about 20, in our experience, we're now producing small quantities of wine. It's called microvinification in our research winery in Ariel University, and we are... analyzing the characteristics of these wines, and actually some of them are amazing, superb wines, very high quality that could be used for international export. So these wines should be very interesting, and they would be the next thing in Israel's wine industry, no doubt.
We will talk much more about Israel's wine industry and this production of really new wine from old grapes, to quote To quote Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah, when we come back in just a few moments with Professor Eliyashi Vruri.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. That's TOOJewishRadio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So good morning, and thank you for bringing your daughter Shira, the junior Shlicha, to come help us today on the radio show. It has been a challenging week in Israel because of all of the terror attacks. Sometimes we feel like we could say that every week, but really it's been difficult. Talk a little bit about an Israeli response to all of these Palestinian terror attacks in the last week.
Yeah. As you can, as you said before, every week is challenging in Israel, and actually every frame in Israel or every occasion cannot be talked without like thinking about what's happened before, what will happen next.
So it's all about context.
It's all about the general context. Yes, you're right. And this week, when I was asked as a shlicha to explain some of the what's happened in Israel, especially people ask me about like the young Palestinian who was running toward the Israeli police car and stabbed the window, and then the policeman came out, and you know, as a stranger, if you wouldn't know from where this video was taken, you would say, he's not threatening
the
policeman anymore.
He can't break
they
the
could
window.
Have you know just I don't know, maybe shoot
in the air, not, do something to stop him,
and not right. Shooting just to kill him. But in Israel, it's nothing can be talked, discussed without the, as he said, without the general context. And since same day and day before and a week before, so many terror, you know,
attacks.
And new terror attacks and new, I would say, escalation in terror in Israel. So I thought that's what the policeman thought, that it's not that their hand was so easy on the trigger, but they thought if it's not now, us now, it will be someone else in 5 minutes or in 5 days.
Or 5 seconds, for
or
that
five,
matter.
You're right.
You could run across
seconds.
The street, find a pedestrian and stab him, which has happened since then.
Yeah,
it's very difficult. And there's talk that this is a third intifada. There's the Hamas is calling for a third intifada. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, the head of the Palestinian Authority, the moderate Fatah has been congratulating the terrorists who have attacked innocent Israelis, killed a baby at a bus stop or at a light rail stop. It's do you think this is a third intifada? Is that what Israelis are saying?
I have a hard time to answer because on one hand I think so, but I hope not.
Right, of course. We all hope not. Thanks, Oshrat. We'll talk next
Thank
week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
They opened a brand new museum of Polish-Jewish experience in Warsaw. Hundreds of millions of dollars, half the money from the Polish government, the rest from Jews around the world. Boy, so many mixed feelings in thinking about the Jews of Poland.
Right. Well, it's a very long, rich, and complicated story, the story of the Jews of Poland. And it happens at one of my close childhood friends, who's a professor at Bar-Ilan. His field is Polish-Jewish history, and he spent semesters, even years occasionally, in Krakow or in Warsaw or both, researching in the archives. And he received some Medal of Honor from the Polish government for the results of his research. And they had originally scheduled the ceremony on some relatively minor Jewish holiday, but Murray is Orthodox.
I'm sorry, there are no minor Jewish holidays.
Right. My friend is Orthodox, and he told them that he wouldn't be able to attend, and they changed the date
for
remarkably.
Him.
Right.
That's fantastic.
So a lot of what I know about the further away aspects, the more remote parts of Polish Jewish history, I know thanks to him. But I've also visited both Krakow and Warsaw many times. And I can tell you that today, the vast, vast majority of students of Yiddish or Jewish music or klezmer music or Yiddish theater in Poland are non-Jews who want to learn about this aspect of their country's past and want somehow to connect with it. There aren't a lot of born Jews living in Poland still. There are a number of Jews by choice and a few sort of Jews by blood, if you will, but not a lot. And it's interesting that this big flourishing of Jewish culture and Yiddish revival and klezmer music happens in Poland, which is a country that we associate with some of the worst parts of Jewish history. On the other hand, those worst parts were actually carried out by Germans on Polish soil, not by Poles themselves. And Poles that I've met engaged in heroic acts of saving Jews or hiding Jews during World War II, and have been honored by Yad Vashem and other Jewish organizations and institutions that recognize the so-called righteous Gentiles. But what I would love to see this new museum, because it is such a rich and complicated story. And at one point, Warsaw had a population that was approximately one-third Jewish.
Yeah.
Early in the 20th century.
Hugely Jewish.
The three biggest Jewish cities in the world where Yiddish was a really commonly spoken language in 1900 were New York, Warsaw, and Odessa.
Yeah.
And those were the three centers of world Jewry. barely 100 years ago. And think how things have changed.
Oh my God, have they ever. Fascinating, and may have the opportunity to go visit that museum on my sabbatical. I'm sure you'll get there soon. But a fascinating, complicated, and rich and painful history. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Jaime enters a Catholic church and heads for the confessional. When the priest asks him, "Tell me why you have come, my son?" Jaime answers, "Some son, I'm 93 years old. My wife, who was 91, died a year ago. We were happily married for 64 years. But last night, I had crazy, joyous sex with a 27-year-old supermodel." The priest is aghast. "When was your last confession, old man?" And Jaime replies, "Why would a Jewish man like me go to confession?" The priest is confused. "If you're Jewish, why are you telling me this story?" And Jaime replies, "I'm telling everyone!" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. The story of the twins, Jacob and Esau, begins in utero. Rivals from before birth, wrestling in their mother Rebecca's womb, the red-haired outdoorsman Esau and his grasping, domestically inclined younger brother Jacob spend our portion of Toldot vying for their father's and mother's love and attention. Each is partly successful and each partly fails. That sibling rivalry shaped the course of our people's early history, but it also teaches us something about ourselves. First, a word about words. Our weekly Torah portion of Toldot is rich in real-life details told in spectacularly perfect writing. Rebecca, pregnant with the two boys wrestling inside her, tells God, "If it's like this, why am I alive?" Prefiguring the words every pregnant mom thinks or says at some point. Esau is hairy and rough at birth, Jacob smooth, born holding fast to Esau's heel. After they grow into young men, Esau, famished from a long hunt, trades his birthright for a bowl of stew to Jacob, and then ate, drank, stood up, left, and disdained. The series of active verbs delineating his turbulent, thoughtless character. Jacob, smooth-faced, smooth-talking lawyer that he is, audibly calculates the coming consequence of every action. Now, on to that little rivalry. The familial tension in Toldot is palpable. In fact, there's tzoras enough to go around for everyone in this small family. Isaac, the father and link between important patriarchs, finds trouble but avoids it by simply moving away. Each time, he seeks and finds more success, but then more trouble, and moves again. Something that later happens to his descendants, us, in every generation. Rebecca sees the wayward ways of her eldest boy, Esau, and chooses to manipulate the situation to give the inheritance to Jacob, remaking the birth order retroactively. But the great struggle is between Jacob and Esau. I'm reminded of the 1960s TV stars The Smothers Brothers' old line, "Mom liked you best." Mom certainly liked Jacob best, but Dad liked Esau best. That kind of favoritism cannot end well, and it doesn't. At the end of our portion, Esau has been doubly defrauded. Jacob is forced to flee the consequences of his own duplicity, running from the only home he has known, without so much as a pillow or blanket. In a sense, the conflicted family damages each of its members. Everyone is wounded, none left really whole. It's a drama worthy of, well, so many of our own lives. And yet, in a couple of more Torah portions, we will see that each member of this now shattered nuclear family has played or will play a central role in furthering God's design for our world. In spite of their mistakes and injuries, each helps ultimately to carry out pivotal elements that further God's mission that will create the great people of Israel. In challenging times and in conflicted families, it's often hard to see that there is a divine plan ultimately, a place for each participant within it. But Toldot, that means generations, by the way, teaches us that in spite of what we might perceive in our own small field of vision, God remains at work in the world, and we might just be furthering a greater plan. Dr. Eliashiv Drori of Ariel University has pioneered the revival of biblical species of grapes in Israel, creating wine from 3,000-year-old seeds that date back to King David's time. Find out what it means to remake an ancient viticulture of Israel in today's wine world and why it's important when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
We're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
It was another challenging week for Arab terror perpetrated by Palestinians in Israel. Two Israelis were murdered and two others injured in a pair of stabbings by Palestinians last week. Signs that weeks of Arab terrorist violence in Jerusalem are now spreading to other parts of Israel and the West Bank. Around midday last Monday, a young Israeli soldier, Almog Shilani, was stabbed by a Palestinian terrorist outside a Tel Aviv train station. The attacker, whom police identify as a resident of the West Bank city of Nablus, fled the scene to a nearby apartment building where he was caught by police special forces. The 20-year-old Israeli boy died at the hospital. Hours later, a second knife-wielding Palestinian terrorist stabbed three Israelis at a bus stop near the West Bank settlement of Alon Shvut, near Bethlehem. First, he tried to run them over with his minivan, then he jumped out and stabbed them with a knife. Dalia Lemkes, a 26-year-old woman who worked as an occupational therapist at a Kiryat Gat kindergarten, died from her wounds. The terrorist was shot by a local security guard. He is now being cared for at an Israeli hospital. Only Israel takes care of terrorists in their own hospitals. Since the beginning of July, Israeli security authorities have struggled to quell rioting in Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem. Fanned by Palestinian provocations and terror acts near holy shrines in Jerusalem's Old City, these attacks have grown to include three murderous terror efforts perpetrated by Palestinian terrorists on innocent pedestrians, including the murder of a baby girl by one of these Palestinian terrorists. This week, the Palestinian provocations spread elsewhere in the country, Tel Aviv, northern Israel. Riots among Israeli Arabs were coordinated by someone in the Palestinian hierarchy just this last weekend. Supposedly, the Palestinian Arab knife murderer in Tel Aviv acted on his own. We'll see. Israel has called both Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Hamas, the Islamist group that rules the Gaza Strip, to account for inciting the terror attacks. Abbas embraced the recent attackers, and Hamas has called for another intifada against Israel. In other distressing news, Hamas is now one of the two richest terror organizations in the world, second only to the Islamic State group ISIS, according to Forbes Israel. To finance their operations, terror groups use methods similar to those used by other criminal organizations like the mafia, drug trafficking, robbery, and extortion, but they also raise money through charities, donations, and, in many cases, government agencies. A terrorist organization, like any other organization, has a business model to finance its activities, Forbes says, from maintenance, salaries, and trainings to acquiring weapons and vehicles. The richest terrorist organization today and in history is the Islamic State. According to Forbes, this Islamist group of terrorists, also known by the acronyms ISIS and ISIL, has an annual turnover of $2 billion. Hamas is second, with a yearly revenue of $1 billion. The U.S. Treasury estimates that ISIS earns about $1 million a day from the sale of crude oil from fields it captured in Syria and Iraq. According to Forbes Israel, however, the figure is closer to $3 million a day. That money enabled ISIS to expand its operations throughout the Middle East, recruit foreign fighters, and train them, among other terror efforts. The report describes Hamas's takeover of Gaza in 2007 as the point from which it entered the big league. Today, Hamas is now no longer dependent on donations. It's able to collect taxes from both civilians and businesses. And that's not all. Hamas takes a cut out of all international aid donated to Gaza by Arab, European, and other foreign countries. In other Israeli news, 106 retired IDF generals, national police commissioners, and former Mossad and Shin Bet spy chiefs signed a letter to Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu urging that he embrace the Saudi peace plan and initiate a diplomatic process based on a regional framework for peace with the Palestinians. The letter was initiated by a former Armored Corps commander, Reserve Major General Amnon Reshef. He said he was tired of a reality of rounds of fighting every few years, instead of a genuine effort to adopt the Saudi initiative. Reshef referred to the Saudi-backed peace proposal, adopted unanimously by the Arab League in 2002, later endorsed 56-0 by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Only Iran abstained. It has since been repeatedly reaffirmed and its terms softened towards Israel, as currently framed. This Saudi effort offers full peace, diplomatic recognition, and normal relations between Arab states and Israel in return for Israeli withdrawal to borders based on the pre-67 armistice lines, with negotiated land swaps and a just and mutually agreed compromise solution to the Palestinians. The general's call echoes a proposal for a regional peace conference floated during the Gaza War this summer by Israel's science minister Yaakov Peri, a member of Yair Lapid's Yesh Atid party, a former director himself of the Shin Bet. It's currently being advocated within the security cabinet by Lapid and Justice Minister Tzipi Livni. Retired generals have occasionally made statements in the past, but never in such numbers, rarely on political matters that aren't directly related to the army. The 106 signers of the current letter to Netanyahu include 101 IDF veterans with the rank of brigadier or major general, two former chiefs of the Mossad, and three former commanders of Israel's National Police. After reflecting on their often heroic national service, the military leaders say this is not a question of left or right. What we have here is an alternative option for resolving the conflict that is not based solely on bilateral negotiations with the Palestinians, which have failed time and again. We expect a show of courageous initiative and leadership from you, Mr. Prime Minister. Lead and we will stand behind you. Netanyahu has not really responded to the letter so far. And the Nobel Prizes for 2014 have been announced, and there must be an error somewhere. Only one person of Jewish ancestry has won a Nobel this year. Last year, in a fairly typical experience, there were six Jewish Nobel Prize winners. The overall total since the beginning of the Nobel Prizes back in 1901 is that 22% have been Jewish. That is, of the 835 individuals who have won or shared a Nobel Prize since they began to award them, 22% have been Jewish. Just a little bit over the Jewish population of the world, which is 0.2%. And then this year, just one literature Nobel Prize winner, the Frenchman Patrick Modiano, whose father is Jewish. Oh, well, wait till next year, I suppose. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Dr. Eliashiv Drori, is the leader of a project that has created, has found 100 unique varieties of grapes going back to Roman times in Israel, and is now in the process of creating, through, as he described earlier in the show, some wines from these. You know, Israeli wine industry is an interesting industry. It was kind of restarted after the long Muslim period, as I understand it, at the initiative of Baron Rothschild. They planted grape vineyards around Zichron Yaakov. Those were French varietals, right?
Actually, what happened was 10 years before that, Mikveh Yisrael was established, and they started by planting indigenous varieties, trying to produce some wines from them. But when Baron Rothschild, they got here, and with his specialists from France, they analyzed these varieties, and they found them unsuitable for wine production. So they brought all of the varieties from France. And so actually the new Israeli wine industry started up with European varieties, mostly Carignan, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and so on. And this is what we still have in the Israeli wine industry up to date. And that's very peculiar. Most ancient world nations produce wine from indigenous varieties. Even in France, they are very strict about growing the right indigenous variety for every region. So they grow the Pinot Noir in Bourgogne, Chardonnay in Bourgogne, Cabernet Sauvignon in Bordeaux, and so on. And their pride, their whole system is built on that. And the wine tourism is built on this distinction. And in Israel, we don't have this story. We actually have a very ancient wine nation and country with a lot of ancient wine presses and a lot of stories, but nothing to show for it today. And that's a big lack. And we are looking forward to changing that by reestablishing these old varieties.
You know, as a wine lover, I can tell you that when I first went to Israel in the 1970s, it wasn't much of a wine industry. They produced a lot of wine. It wasn't good. Now, Israeli wines win a variety of competitions. They're really quite spectacular, but they're not from indigenous varietals. They're French or sometimes California and other varieties, right?
That's true. We do get a lot of recognition in our very, very well-made wines. I myself have own a private winery called Vault Winery, and we win a lot of prizes in international competitions. But there's a big difference between winning competitions and actually selling the wine. Meaning that when you are in the market, and there are a few Bordeaux wines and one Israeli wine. So if you're a kosher wine buyer, okay, you'll buy the Israeli wine because they're kosher. But if you're not, there's no way you will buy the Cabernet Sauvignon from Israel and not the Cabernet Sauvignon from Bordeaux. That's how it works. So if you want to actually be compatible in the international level, you have to show something that is unique and that will be interesting and will pull the attention of the crowds. And that would be only if we have our own indigenous story.
How long does it take to develop and get to market a varietal that people are unfamiliar with, even if it has Roman period, maybe even biblical associations?
Actually, I think that the wine community today, the wine consumers, are looking for something new. They are quite tired of the old varieties. They're looking all the time for new places, new styles, and so on. Now, if you actually give them the story of the wine of David, or if they're Christian, the wine of Jesus, yeah, for that case. So this is a big story. It's a big, big thing. And people go and buy wines in very, very far away places because they like the story. They like the way the people there live and produce the wines. So if we actually be able to make the story, to make the essence of the Israeli wine as a connection to old biblical stories, that would be a big market thing, I believe.
So you mean the wine that the Tanakh, the Torah, the Bible says, Yayin Yismach Levav Enosh, wine glads the heart of man, was not Manischewitz?
Probably not. We know that the wines were very strong. We know how they did them. We actually have close neighbors in Cyprus still doing that. They actually partially dried the grapes, and they produced wines of very, very high concentration of both sugar and alcohol. These wines could be saved and aged for a very long time, and they could actually, they couldn't be drank as they are. They would be diluted in water. This is why all the conversations in the Talmud about
right, about mixing,
how much you could actually add and so on. These all come from the reason it was actually a syrup, a kind of very, very condensed wine.
Like a syrup.
That they used to produce, like a syrup. Surely not Manischewitz. They were very high, high polyphenolic, high colored, and high sugared wines. Suited for long aging and very, very good for disinfection of water and so on. You should think about it. It was very difficult drinking water from a well in Israel during August or September, after half a year of no rain. So you could guess what would go on in the water.
Sure, very
that
dangerous.
Be a very good
probably.
Way to yeah to
high,
disinfect.
High bacteria
so
concentration.
They actually they would disinfect or they would dilute the wine into water, and there you get a very good drink. Safe and tasty.
Huh. The process of making really fine wine, it usually takes a long time for people to come to respect a wine. How long do you think it takes to really know how to take a new varietal, really a new old, an Alt Neuland, kind of something that goes back to biblical times almost, and turn it into something that's really a quality wine? You said in your microviticulture you've had really good success with some varietals.
The microvinification process takes amounts of 2 kilograms up to maybe 50 kilograms, and we produce the wines mostly for analysis purposes, not just chemical analysis, but also organoleptic, by tasting. So we know now, after 3 years of experience, that some varieties are for sure suitable for wine production. There is a process going through upscaling to go up and see that nothing happens when you actually produce big quantities. And for some varieties, we're actually doing that this year. And the others would get there next year, a year later, because of the Shemitah. So,
right, the year of sabbatical this year.
Process of 3 or 4 years. And then you can actually start putting it back into the industry and interesting, the winemakers of Israel's wine industry come in to my lab a few times a year, tasting new varieties and discussing them, and they are very, very much interested. They call me all the time. When would this one go out? When would this one go out? They're very enthusiastic. They don't have much patience. Anyway, after we decide, we still have to plant these vines, because mostly we found one plant or two plants, so we actually have to make some plantlets. It would take a few years, but we have some, we waited 2,000 years. We can wait 5 or 6 more years to have the new vineyard.
Imagine that, Israelis being impatient about getting something done. I was thinking about how much more the entrepreneurial spirit in Israel affects everything. I can't imagine in France the French embracing, an ancient Franc varietal quickly and getting it to market quickly in a place that's filled with laws about wine. Are there restrictions in Israel? Besides the kashrut labeling, are there the same kinds of quality control restrictions in Israel?
Quality control we have, but very, very, rough. They're not very accurate, and that's a good thing, because I hope that we'll be fast enough to put in the lists enough varieties before new laws are made. I guess that in a few years, because of the development in Israeli wine industry, laws will come in too, like they do in every country. But we hope they will be as versatile as possible and that we will not be restricted by these laws. For now, there's no restriction, actually. We can produce wine from any grapevine variety. And there was a joke that one of the old wine business owners in Israel, when he died, he called all of his sons and he told them, come closer, I want to tell you a big, big secret. And then they all bent down and he told them, you know, you could actually produce wine out of grapes. So that's a big joke. It's not a big joke, actually, but it was true for many years in Israel. Wine was produced not only from pure grapes,
but grain alcohol.
For now, let's say if we talk about being true, you could actually produce wine from any grape variety in Israel. There's no restriction about that.
Last question. The archaeological sites, I would assume many of them are Roman period, but have you found grapes? What's the oldest grape evidence that you've collected, the varietal that goes back the furthest on archaeological sites?
Okay, well, we found, I think the most interesting finding was not the most ancient one. We found some very ancient ones from the 13th century before Christ, but the most interesting one, it was found by Dr. Eilat Mazar from the Hebrew University. She dug in the Ophel. Ophel is the fortress of the Har HaBayit.
That's on Temple Mount.
Right. She found, very, very interesting, she found whole grapes burned, a big, big amount of burned grapes, whole. They're actually whole. You can see the whole grape. And these are dated to the time of the building, the construction of the first temple, for the time of Shlomo.
Wow.
So that's a very, very interesting finding, maybe even David, so it's somewhere in between. This is a very interesting finding, and we are very enthusiastic about finding the identity of this specific variety because it was connected directly to a phrase written on a pot. It's written there, Yain Chalak. Yain Chalak, smooth wine. It was actually a name for, let's say, kind of Manischewitz wine. These were the simple wines given to the workers in the working site. But this is for sure, it's quite sure that these grapes came out of a jar of wine. So they were actually either raisins used for production of very cheap wine or grapes that were still remained in the wine. So we have these grapes, and we are now analyzing them. And if we will have luck, maybe they suit, they resemble one of our varieties that we found today in our collection, and that would be very nice to have.
Well, fascinating. So really the wine of David and Solomon, that would be a remarkable find, and it's incredible to think about something of that ancients. I want to thank Professor Dr. Eliashiv Drori for his great visit here from Ariel University. I hope someday to be able to toast you with some of King David's wine.
Bezrat Hashem and L'chaim.
L'chaim. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Eric Lichtblau, author of the new book, The Nazis Next Door, How America Became a Safe Haven for Hitler's Men. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is from our guest last week, the wonderful violinist Vadim Gluzman, featured December 5th, 6th, and 7th with the Tucson Symphony at Music Hall and at the Symphony Center. It's part of Vadim's rendition of the Baal Shem Tov Symphony of Ernest Bloch, called Simchat Torah. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.